This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Father's Day is Sunday, and that gives us an opportunity to acknowledge all our dads do for us. But just ahead of that, we want to revisit the role of our moms with an extended version of an interview we first shared last month on the history of motherhood. UW-La Crosse Women's Studies and History professor Jody Vandenberg Daves is the author of Modern Motherhood and American History. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked her why she wrote the book.
There was a need for this book, and I had a very strong, longstanding interest in it. I became a mother nearly 22 years ago, and I was already finishing my doctorate in women's history and, broadly speaking, social history. And I felt like this experience needed to be understood from a historical perspective. So I first taught the class at McAllister College when I was an adjunct professor there. And then when I came here in 1999, I developed it as part of my regular course rotation. And as I taught the class, I realized there were lots of little studies about aspects of motherhood, but there was no overarching history of the subject, even though there had been attempts to do kind of overarching histories of women in general. What really kind of made me realize the absence was when I saw a very good history of childhood by Stephen Mintz. And I thought, if he can do this for childhood, I bet it can be done for motherhood.
Now, your book is being marketed anyway as the first comprehensive history.
Yes.
Of motherhood in America. Why hasn't there been one written before?
I think one of the reasons has to do with the traditions of history. In other words, history started as a field about great men. And since the 1960s and 70s, we've had a lot more research into the lives of ordinary people, into women's history, feminist approaches to history. However, one of the things that animated that discussion back then was helping women get access to the public arenas to which they had long been denied access. For example, helping women have a broader place in the labor force, expand their access to higher education, get into politics. And so for a long time and still today, a lot of history of women is written about their struggles to get to access those areas, which is very important history and needs to be done. The history of private life, I think there is a little bit of a cultural bias that we, you know, that's just not really history. But I also think it's harder. You have to be very resourceful to find that history because the lives of mothers have often not been considered worthy of story or study. Mothers have been very busy and often have not been asked to sit down and talk about their experiences, have often not had time to write down those experiences. So sometimes you get glimpses of mothers' lives, even in what I did here, more than I would have liked. You have to go through the eyes of experts or people talking to mothers. There's still, I wish there was more. I've tried to do what I could with what historians have found. It's really a synthesis of many other people's work here as historians.
Your book starts with the formation of America, really. What was it like to be a mother at the time America was being formed?
It definitely depended on who you were. It depended on your class and race quite a bit, what it was like to be a mother, as it still does today in many respects. The Puritans would have a very long-lasting impact on our cultural norms about motherhood, so I do spend a fair amount of time with them. They had the idea that children were willful little beings who really needed a father's discipline. Fathers were considered the morally superior of the two parents, the important disciplinarians, spare the rod, spoil the child. Even when you see Puritan children pictured in art, they look like full-grown adults, just miniature. Puritans even discouraged crawling. They wanted children to be upright as fast as possible and independent. And this is not maybe just entirely a Puritan thing. Children were valued for their labor, and they needed to be disciplined to be laborers in many parts of the world at that time. Of course, the situation was different for enslaved mothers, different for women who were in the southern colonies, many of whom came over as indentured servants. And if they got pregnant while they were indentured servants, they'd have to extend their term as indentured servants. So it really varied a lot, but I do spend a fair amount of time with the Puritan Puritans, because one of their things too was that the father was the head of the family, and that women's labor as mothers and in general was less valued than it was in, say, Native cultures or African cultures. And so that carried forward in American history, the idea that women's role is a secondary role. The Puritans called the wife the helpmeet. In other words, she helped her husband. So that kind of separation and somewhat devaluing of women's labor had an impact later on in American history.
There's a shift to something called moral motherhood, mm-hmm. or Republican with a small r.
Yes.
Could you talk about that, please?
A historian named Linda Kerber defined the term Republican motherhood with a small r, which was the idea in the early American Republic, right in the era of the American Revolution and afterwards, that mothers were the moral guardians of the nation. They would regard the new republic, which was, you know, this great experiment in self-government for Americans. There were, you know, ideas flowing across the Atlantic about women having a little bit broader role in citizenship, but those ideas were squelched pretty quickly. And the idea was that women's role as citizens was to raise the next generation of male citizens. So they would teach their sons how to be moral and upright citizens. It's an interesting development because in some ways, it elevated women as reasonable and later even more sentimental and moral people. And some historians say part of the reason that ideology developed is that you had the rough and tumble world of commerce that was really heating up in this era, and men were sort of empowered to go out into that sphere, while women would keep the hearth and they would keep the kind of moral center of the family. And by the 1830s, it's more this moral motherhood, which is much more religiously infused. It's a little bit less Protestant religious infusion. It's a little bit less about the new republic and a political role, and it's more privatized. It's more mothers. The language about mothers was extremely flowery and sentimental, and very sacred. So a mother had to be more or less selfless and ideal as the role model for her child. And the new idea about children was they were innocent, and they needed the guidance of a selfless, pious, you know, very feminine influence of the mother, that was a more important force now than the role of the father. And it makes sense if you see children as innocent beings that you would say, oh, they're going to be governed by inspiration of this beautiful feminine figure. And the child-rearing advice of that time period, I use it. I look at those documents with my students, and they're kind of amazed, like, never show anger, you know, those kinds of things. Meanwhile, the role of the fathers in raising children becomes de-emphasized in that time period. So that moral motherhood really invests women with this singular responsibility in terms of their children's character development. And when I go into the diary and letter evidence available at that time, of which there's a little bit more, but it's almost all white middle-class women. Still, what I find from that limited source base is what seems to be a growing self-consciousness about that role and more introspection about doing it right and the weighty responsibility of having that child's character development in your hands.
What was men's job when there was that shift?
You're seeing more of an elaboration of the idea of men as the breadwinners, and the Industrial Revolution is beginning, and there starts to be more of a separation of home and workplace. So in the colonies, most people, their home and work were one place. Mm-hmm. And as you start to see that separation, men who do leave the home for work are away from their families more during the day, and you start to see this language about the home as the haven, the place away from the workplace, which the mother keeps as this beautiful, perfect space. And you can imagine forward how that idea is still there in the 1950s with June Cleaver. It's a very long-standing idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And today, to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, the domestic advice literature is directed at women today.
Right.
Who keeps the home? Who's in the Mr. Clean ads?
Right.
It's women. Yes.
Right.
Still the domestic housekeepers and ideology anyway.
There is also a very compelling chapter in the book that really deals with issues involving motherhood and slavery. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the significance that slavery had on motherhood.
I try to, for one thing, help modern readers understand what it would be like to be in a situation where your children could be sold away from you at any moment, and where your authority with your children, and this was true for enslaved women as well as enslaved men, your authority over your children was not complete either, because they could be told what to do by an owner. The vulnerability of African-American mothers in that situation is something I spend a fair amount of time on in the book. The reality of the enslaved mother coexists with this idea of moral motherhood and mothers keeping the hearth. And there's an incredible contradiction there that some people pick up on. And it drives the abolitionist movement to some extent. There is also, in the aftermath of slavery, the necessity of both parents to work among African Americans because of the amazing economic disenfranchisement that is still there. You know, the sharecropping system, the Jim Crow system, institutionalized racism in really very overwhelming forms meant that for African American women, the high rates of labor force participation would continue long after slavery. And so that idea of the stay-at-home mother was always much less accessible to African American women.
No matter what era you live in, really, things like family planning and reproductive rights, birth control, abortion, always been a struggle for mothers for the most part. And could you talk a little bit about how those issues have been different at different times in our country?
Yeah, that wound up being a pretty big theme in the book. One of the things that probably a lot of people don't know is that in kind of pre-modern times, no one knew whether a woman was pregnant except possibly the woman. there were a lot of conditions in which women might stop menstruating, but not necessarily know they were pregnant. There were no urine tests. Of course, there were no ultrasounds. You couldn't see into a woman's interior of a woman's body the way you can today. Mm-hmm. When women did not menstruate, sometimes they would do different things to restore menses, as they said. They would take potions for different kinds of herbs. And in the traditional view, a woman was not definitively pregnant until about 4.5 months of gestation. It was called quickening. And that was when fetal movements were felt. And so abortion, there were some criminal statutes about abortion in the colonies, but they mainly had to do with whether a woman was killed in the process of trying to perform an abortion. It was not criminalized generally before that 4.5 month period. But what happened in the 19th century is physicians developed a different view of when life began. Part of it was their studies of embryology, but they were also trying to establish themselves professionally. And they redefined in many ways when life begins and contributed very vocally to new laws that criminalized abortion. So that, along with that, went the politicization of birth control. Women had used, again, stuff in their gardens to try to regulate their reproduction. Throughout history, we know that people have regulated their reproduction in a whole variety of ways. If they had not done that, women would have many, many more babies than we see in the historical record. So we know they've always done that. But what changes is it becomes politicized in the mid to late 19th century, both abortion and birth control. And we see then in the early 20th century the crusade of Margaret Sanger to allow women contraceptive access to limit births. And the pushback she gets from that is remarkable. What is even more remarkable to me is that we're refighting those battles today. I never thought it would happen. Abortion, yes, that's been controversial for a very long time. But the idea that even birth control is becoming controversial. What's really interesting to read about in the early 20th century is the letters that were written to Margaret Sanger and also to the U.S. Children's Bureau, where it becomes clear that most of the women who were asking for birth control were already mothers and wanted to not have any more children because they knew they could not afford more babies. They were legitimately afraid of dying in childbirth or suffering debilitating health effects and of leaving behind motherless children. And that's what you see very often in the letters. And that the whole system that had been defined for American mothers, that you're supposed to be supported by a man, was particularly not working very well in the Great Depression. And even leading up to that, there were many families for whom that model never really worked. And so they would say, you know, my husband can't support our family in this situation. We need to not have any more babies. Today, women are using birth control still. The Guttmacher Institute has done studies on the use of birth control. And women, of course, their lives have changed a lot. Much more access to education and the labor force on their own terms. And birth control helps women achieve those goals by deciding when and whether they'll be a mother. Margaret Sanger said something to the effect that no woman can ever call herself free who can't decide when and whether she becomes a mother. And so, you know, here we are nearly 100 years after she opened the first birth control clinic, and we've gone back to debating that question.
Another issue that I think is a theme in the book is the issue of women and work, both inside and outside the home. And it really first pops up in the 19th century. But those are still issues that we're dealing with today.
Yeah. I mean, of course, women have always worked, and the work in the home has often been invisible. The nature of the work in the home changed a lot as the Industrial Revolution advanced. And then also the separation of home and work created a dilemma for women who worked outside the home. So we have this longstanding idea of the male breadwinner that kind of really gets amplified in the Industrial Revolution. And yet women kept needing to work. The male breadwinner model didn't work for people whose husbands didn't make enough money for them to stay home or who were not married. We really see the strains on that. And I spent a lot of time on the period of the first several decades of the 20th century, and we really see those strains of women facing that male breadwinner model. What happens over the course of the 20th century is women just keep increasing their labor force participation, despite all the ideology telling them not to, despite all the suggestions that their children will suffer or that their husbands will suffer. There's interesting literature about that, you know, that it will emasculate men if women work and those kinds of things. Women knew they needed to work. What happens with the second wave of the feminist movement in particular is that women, because there's feminist activism, gain more potential to define the nature of that work on their own terms, to ask for more opportunities and better pay. And it's coming more slowly and unevenly, but hopefully some accommodations of caregiving, which benefit not just women, but anybody who has caregiving responsibilities.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. I'm talking with UW La Crosse Women's Studies and History Professor Jody Vandenberg-Daves. She's written a comprehensive history of motherhood in the United States. It's called Modern Motherhood in American History. The last 65 years or so, from the 1950s on, I would think are the most radical changes for mothers.
Pretty rapid.
Yeah.
Pretty rapid. Yeah. We see, you know, certainly there's some continuity as well. The moral motherhood idea seems to kind of get revived in many different ways. Maternal activism that we see a lot of in the progressive era, 1890 to 1920, has its new and really fascinating forms in the 60s and 70s. So we see some continuity there. The continuity that also that women are underrepresented in public policy, but change, so much demographic change and a fair amount of ideological challenges to some of these older motherhood ideals. So we're seeing in those last 65 years, for example, the stigma on single mothers vastly, vastly reduced. You no longer get kicked out of high school for being a single mother, or perhaps, as happened to many women in the 1950s, sent to a maternity home to deliver the baby in secret and never see it again. More than half of births to American women under 30 happen outside of marriage. That is a very, very significant change over time. We also see lesbian parents, gay parents. We see with our fraying safety net, particularly the last 20 years or so, I keep noticing these pieces of evidence that intergenerationally, we're relying on one another a little bit more. The very private nuclear family ideal that emerged in the 19th century has never been fully workable for many Americans, and we're seeing a return, I think, to lots of different patterns of relying on one another, not just a husband and wife and two kids. So that's really changed. Mothers are working outside the home more and more, and they're working – they're going back to work when their children are younger. That's another kind of a pattern that you really see since the World War II era. So even in the 50s, we had a lot of women participating in the labor force, but oftentimes that was invisible because they worked part-time. They'd be home when the school bus got off. They worked when their children were ages 5 to 18. Now we're seeing many women returning to work before, you know, when their babies are quite young. And that pattern has been fairly continuous over time. So those are a few pieces of it.
Why do you think there is still a struggle in today's society with many of the themes in the book, be it, birth control and abortion, women in the workplace? We've seen a recent debate over why most women make less than men. There's a motherhood penalty in the workplace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're a mother, you're paid less than a woman who's not a mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'll start with the reproductive rights issue. Trying to be a little careful how I wade into this, but I think there is a lot of ambivalence about the rising role of women in the public world. And I think that the backlash against reproductive rights is partly a backlash against that, against women having public roles. We see that way back in the middle of the 19th century, that women, it's going to upset the whole social order of things. And I think with these rapid changes in women's lives and family lives, I sometimes feel like the abortion debate is sort of a stand-in debate for a lot of those other things. It gets so emotional because it's tied up with our ideas of womanhood and of families. Some of the research on this by some interesting historians and anthropologists suggests that women who oppose abortion, sometimes their reasoning is about you should just accept and make that sacrifice. The whole society is driven by these kind of consumer commercial values. Women who accept any pregnancy are being heroic. On the other side of that, of course, women who champion reproductive rights for women point out that to not give women those rights is profoundly disempowering in so many ways. Economically, the ability to leave relationships that might be abusive, in a sense that, going back to Margaret Sanger, if you can't choose when and whether you become a mother, you have a lot less power in your life. And becoming a mother has a profound impact on women's lives. Feminists help women gain access to better opportunities in the workforce, but the traditional professional career path remains somewhat rigid and somewhat defined by the idea that you never have any interruptions in your career path. And when you had a situation where men could support an entire family, which was, not the norm for most people, but it was a little bit more the norm for more people in the 1950s, then it was a different situation. Women inherited these kinds of professional opportunities, but they didn't become very accommodating to caregiving. And I think part of the continuing ambivalence about working mothers, part of it is we're not putting the spotlight on working fathers. We have a Working Mother magazine. We don't have a Working Father magazine. There's still so much gender socialization that of course men will work. Of course it's part of being a man to support your family. But being a woman, that's a little bit less defined. And I think that we as Americans have lost so much leisure time in the last 30 or 40 years. And we often have two people working very hard and not doing much better than one person working very hard in the workplace a generation ago. And so we have a lot of families that are really tired and a lot of concern about how are we dealing with children and people who have needs. We used to assign that role to women. Now we've assigned it to often poorly paid women caregivers, in childcare. where we have, you know, we have subsidized education K-12, and to the extent that we have, and that's its whole its own issue. But teachers there get a salary and are considered professionals. Child care workers, like on this campus, we have amazing professionals who are child care workers, and they are highly qualified, but we don't consider that something that we are going to subsidize. And therefore, child care workers are usually paid not very well. And parents, on the other hand, usually can't afford to pay them very well. So we have a high turnover rate in many situations, not here, but in some situations we have a high turnover rate. Then there's a concern as a society, who's minding our children? Who's minding our neighborhoods? Who's caring for our elderly? Families are trying to do that on top of very long work weeks. And women are still doing that somewhat more in the aggregate on average than men are, both child care and elder care. So a lot of women feel like, oh, I'm working now, but I'm still piling all these other things on. So the other thing is, because the workplace has not been more accommodating to caregiving, we have an attrition rate for women who might be seeking leadership opportunities. We don't have very good temporary off-ramps and then getting back on-ramps into workplace opportunities that could lead to leadership. And so our pay gap, our promotion gap, our leadership gap, even our gap in political representation all connect in some ways to these challenges of how we've defined the public sphere as for men who never interrupt their lives. They just go straight forward while the wife picks up the dry cleaning and takes care of the kids. And I know a lot of men don't live that way now, but that's how these things have been defined. And so it's far easier to access those opportunities if you don't have children. And that's why we're even seeing these studies showing that the pay gap has narrowed for women who don't have children, between women who don't have children and men. But for women who do have children, that gap is bigger.
Jody Vandenberg-Daves is a women's studies and history professor at UW-La Crosse. She's the author of the book Modern Motherhood and American History. She spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archive at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.